I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. In June 1964, three young civil rights workers were murdered outside of Philadelphia, Mississippi, in Neshoba County. The state of Mississippi refused to press charges against the local Klansmen for murder. Sentenced under federal law, none ever spent more than a few years in jail, and the ringleader, Edgar Ray Killen, was never convicted. What was unusual about the 2004 commemoration wasn't that Neshoba County whites finally joined their black neighbors in breaking the silence about the town's past. This had already happened 15 years earlier. What made the 2004 commemoration different was that it gave rise to a multiracial task force called the Philadelphia Coalition, whose work went far beyond the commemoration. The Philadelphia Coalition went on to help bring justice to Edgar Ray Killen, to make civil rights education mandatory across the state, and to help establish a South African-style Truth and Reconciliation Commission to look at racially motivated crimes in the state's past. In this episode, we'll look at how commemorations can bring people together in powerful ways and become something larger, something much more transformative than anything originally imagined. At Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina, Claire Whitlinger is an associate professor of sociology. Claire believes that if particular conditions are met, members of otherwise divided communities can forge a shared identity, a powerful feeling of solidarity, and a mission to take on larger goals and objectives. How this happened with the Philadelphia Coalition is the focus of her book, Between Remembrance and Repair, Commemorating Racial Violence in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Claire, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So the focus is on your book is looking at commemorations, a couple and one in particular in Mississippi, and trying to understand when commemorations go from just being an event to something more transformative, something with a larger long-term impact for the community or a wider region. So could you begin with, you're looking at a commemoration of a particular event that's known as the Mississippi Burning Murders. I don't know if that's a more recent way to describe it. Mm-hmm. Could you begin by explaining, well, what were those murders and then what happened? What was the legal outcome of all that?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me set the scene a little bit. So in 1964, civil rights organizations had been working at this point for years in Mississippi, which was a state that seemed particularly resistant to efforts at voter registration. A group of civil rights organizations came together to plan what was then called the Mississippi Summer Project, or Freedom Summer. And so the plan was to recruit college students to spend their summer in Mississippi registering local African Americans to vote, running freedom schools, civic education, lots of projects related with the Freedom Summer. But what's most well known is this voter registration efforts. So these volunteers were largely white college students from the North. Over half of the volunteers were Jewish, from some of the most elite institutions in the country. And the idea was to train these students, send them to Mississippi, and they would spend their summer, registering folks to vote. So at the time, it was understood by folks who had been involved in the civil rights movement that there was real risk to this work. And yet I don't think anyone would have anticipated what happened and what happened on the very first week that the project was set to launch. So in Neshoba County, Mississippi, there had been a church, Mount Zion United Methodist Church, that had been firebombed by the local Klan while the Freedom Volunteers were being trained in Ohio. So three of the folks who were involved in the Freedom Summer Project, two civil rights workers and one Freedom Summer volunteer, traveled down to Neshoba County to investigate the firebombing of this church. Their names were James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner. They investigated. They went to the church to investigate the bombing, spoke to folks. And during that time, the Klan, who had been looking out in particular for Michael Schwerner, observed that these three activists were in town. So these three young civil rights activists, and they were young, the oldest of them was 24, were arrested on trumped up speeding charges, held in the local jail while the Klan had a chance to organize. And essentially what happened is they were released into the hands of a group of about 21 local men, all affiliated with the Klan, including local law enforcement officers, who then abducted Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, took them into a rural part of the county, and shot them at short range, buried their bodies in hopes that they would never be found again. But that's not what happened. The FBI launched a massive investigation, swarmed Neshobee County, and thanks to really good police work, were able to locate the bodies after an excruciating 44-day search. And the FBI did end up retrieving confessions from those who had been involved in the party. So we know with excruciating detail exactly what happened in those fateful final hours.
So there was a trial, and there were some people who were held accountable, but how far did justice go?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the trial that took place in 1967, so 3 years later. There were 18 individuals who were indicted on federal charges for denying the civil rights of Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman. Now, this is notable because the charge of murder is a state charge and could only be brought by the state of Mississippi, which did not seem interested or willing to do so. So the federal government indicted these men on federal charges. Of the 18, seven were convicted. None served more than 6 years. So this is also really interesting in the story, right? Because many of these individuals who were convicted of the violation of civil rights, which was in effect the removal of life, right, ended up moving back into the community and living pretty normal lives.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. So the state could have brought the heaviest charges against them, but it chose not to, right? So it was actually the federal government that comes in and pursues the only case it can make.
Correct.
And the the sentencing is pretty light, for three people being murdered, basically.
Absolutely. And I think what's also particularly interesting about this 1967 case is that there was one individual by the name of Edgar Ray Killen who would have been convicted if not for one holdout juror who said they could never convict a preacher. So he was ultimately not convicted in that trial.
So you have the mastermind who's completely let off the hook. Nothing. Correct. No, nothing for him. So then you have this period that follows these murders in 1964, where there's no major commemoration, is it fair to say, until you get to this 1989 period, and you describe this period, or you note that this is a period known as the Long Silence. So how accurate is that description of this period from 1964 to the first big commemoration, 1989, as the Long Silence?
Yeah, I found this really puzzling when I started doing this research. And I should say that I came to this research unexpectedly, right? So I was going to the state because of my interest in truth commissions. And I had heard that there was an organization in the state of Mississippi that was trying to launch a statewide truth commission. And that was, I lived in South Africa. I was really interested in how the South African style truth commissions were being adopted and adapted in a U.S. context. But right as I was driving down to the state, my first time to Mississippi, one of my advisors had received notification through a sort of HNET, HistoryNet sort of resource, that there was going to be a commemoration marking the, you know, the anniversary of the 1964 Mississippi burning murders. And so I thought, well, I'm headed down that way. Why not sort of swing through and see what's going on? And what I came to learn was that I think, I'm trying to think what year that was, right? But I think that was something like the 43rd annual commemoration of the murders. And so it was really interesting then stepping back into the scholarly literature and seeing this period between 1964 and 1989 as described by some as the long silence. And for those who don't use that term, it was, for those scholars who don't use that term, it was implicit that this was a time where the local community was sort of rife with silence and denial and really would not talk about this history or acknowledge it in any way. And that's partly true. I think what scholars who were writing, you know, characterizing Neshoba County in that way, were really talking about the sort of dominant, you know, the sort of white dominated public sphere. So it is true to say that the local government did not acknowledge this. It was not taught in public schools. It was not sort of openly part of discussion. But that also overlooks a really important part of the story, which was that local people, mostly African Americans, were commemorating this every single year. Beginning in 1964, the first commemoration, which was really a memorial service, took place about 12 days after the bodies were discovered on the charred ruins of Mount Zion, the church that had been fired bombed and had lured Janie Schwerner and Goodman to Neshoba County and ultimately to their death, right? And it's a remarkable memorial service because it takes place on they built a stage on the charred ruins of the church. And you have James Chaney's little brother, Ben, who was 11 years old, speaking to the crowd and saying that he's not afraid, they should not be afraid, and that they're not afraid of Sheriff Rainey. Sheriff Rainey was looking on at that memorial service, at that commemoration service. And so 11-year-old Ben Chaney is actually speaking to one of the men who killed his brother. Right. I mean, this is a remarkable courage. Right. So that was 1964. In 1965, there was a march from the center of town, about 4 miles out to where Mount Zion is. Over 200 folks gathered for this march. In 1966, Martin Luther King came to Neshoba County and led the second annual commemoration service. That turned violent very quickly, and Martin Luther King later described that as one of the scariest moments of his life, and so on and so on. So it became an annual tradition, and every year on June 21st, there's at least one, sometimes multiple commemoration services acknowledging this history. So to describe this as this period as a long silence, right, isn't quite right. In fact, it's actually quite, I think, wrong.
So you have these people, these memory carriers, you describe them as, that they play this instrumental role. You have this past that gets silenced by the white community. It's suppressed there, but it lives on in the African-American community. It gets remembered. The churches in particular keep it alive. There are these events that take place. And you stress that these memory carriers play a critical role during difficult periods. So what is the significance? What role do they play?
Yeah, as you said, a critical role. So one thing we haven't mentioned yet is that 1989 is a really notable year in this story for a couple of reasons. The film Mississippi Burning had just come out in 1988, an Oscar-winning film by Alan Parker that sort of, really reignited national interest in this 25-year-old case. And so we'll get to that, I think, in a little bit, the sort of 25th anniversary commemoration. But prior to that moment, as you noted, the memory of these murders sort of lived on in quiet corners of the county, sometimes not so quiet. And one thing I think is really notable is that in 1972, a local church, Mount Nebo Baptist Church, erected a monument outside their church, honoring the lives of Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, with their photographs, you know, on this, what sort of looks like a gravestone, right? But it's placed outside. And this church is in the heart of downtown Philadelphia, which is the county seat of Neshoba County, right? That's 1972, right? So it's not, so we're seeing really powerful acts of institutionalizing this memory happening within the Black community, in particular Black churches, who are organizing not only these annual commemoration services that nearly always involved very public and visible marches several miles through town, but actually transforming the built environment, the landscape, by erecting permanent memorial structures long before the state ever did.
So private individuals keep this alive during a time where there's not a whole lot of willingness or desire to address this past. This has come up in other episodes. I mean, I interviewed Jenny Wustenberg on memory activists in Germany, and she made the same point that the survivor families really played an instrumental role in preserving a memory. And then you get to a point later on where the culture starts to become more receptive to that past, but they've already done the hard work of keeping it alive, and they pass it on. It may change later with those who take up the reins. So you're mentioning, well, the context does change. You have this movie that comes out creates more of a desire, more of a willingness to address this past. So what was the significance of the movie?
I really think that the significance of the movie can't be understated. I mean, 25 years had passed since 1964. And when we think about that in generational terms, right, I mean, that's an entire generation of folks who had grown up never hearing about the Mississippi Burning, never really understanding this, just beginning to really understand the civil rights movement. These were very sort of early days. Now, we had documentaries like Eyes on the Prize that was doing a lot of really important work. But I think what Alan Parker, the director of Mississippi Burning, was trying to do is bring a deeply emotional connection to this history. However, historically inaccurate the film is, and it is inaccurate in some notable ways. But there was a lot of pushback against the film. But anyway, he felt really strongly about what he was doing, and this film, for many local Neshoba Countyans, was the first time they had ever really heard of this past in any significant detail, right? So this is significant for a couple of reasons. So one, local folks begin to sort of question and begin to sort of understand what had happened. But perhaps even more significantly, folks outside of Mississippi became interested in the story. And so what happened in 1989 in the lead up to the 25th anniversary is that local folks in Philadelphia and Neshoba County began to get wind that people were going to come, right? So people from New York, from Philadelphia, from California, from all over were planning to descend, to come to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and in particularly Mount Zion to commemorate the past. And so sort of whether they liked it or not, these folks were coming. And this was really significant also just because of the size of Philadelphia, Mississippi. Then it was probably about maybe 6,000 people. Now it's about up to 7,000. And to have potentially hundreds, if not thousands of people coming to the state who wanted to hear about this history, something had to be done. And so local folks began to organize.
It's so hard not, especially after reading Dave Tell's book, not to wonder, well, is there an economics behind here? It's like they realize the movie has drawn a lot of attention to the community. People are gravitating to it. There's not a whole lot of understanding of it. Not a lot has been done. I mean, that's kind of a cynical reading of it. So I hate to go too far down that road, but you wonder, you know, to what extent did that play into people's thinking?
Yeah, it most definitely played a role. I think maybe even more so in 2004 at the 40th anniversary that we'll talk about, I'm sure, in just a second. But I think the economic concerns in Philadelphia are really tied to reputational concerns, right? So the 1964 murders had created a reputational dilemma for the town and for the county. Even within Mississippi, folks didn't want to go to Neshoba County, right? I mean, it was understood to be the worst of the worst. I think I write in my book, the most maligned city in the most maligned state, right? And so that has economic implications. If people aren't coming through, if they don't want to host events, if they don't want to tour, and if businesses don't want to come in. And so I think in 1989, part of the interest in formalizing a commemoration was that it was going to happen anyway, right? But if the community were to sort of take responsibility for it and do it on their own terms, they also had the opportunity to really rewrite the story, or at least to clearly indicate on what was going to be a national stage that they had turned a page, right? And that they were fundamentally different than they were in 1964. So I would say economics and reputation are really tied up together.
But there's also a sincere desire among people to project a different image of their community and to show that, hey, we're not the same, maybe, or we become something very, very different.
Yeah. And because, I mean, folks in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and Neshoba County, like many people in communities all over the country, you know, have deep love for where they come from, right? I mean, they really didn't want these murders in 1964 at the hands of, you know, 18 plus Klansmen to be what defined their community in perpetuity. They wanted to tell a different story.
And I think you stress too that it's important to distinguish between difficult histories and silence past, which I've never done in any of the previous episodes. And you point out that if you have cases like this where people know about something that's happened and they intentionally suppress that memory, that's a silenced past. And that takes a lot more work to really push that out into the open and to start to deal with it. I mean, so maybe you need a movie like this, a blockbuster movie. Maybe you need for the town to become a center of attention. Maybe a lot more has to go on behind the scenes for people to really, for that silence to be broken.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing this up, because this is something I've actually continued to do a lot of thinking about and still need to do a lot of thinking about, because in this field of memory work, I think we do often use the term difficult pasts as a catch-all to describe lots of different types of things that actually do have fundamentally different social dynamics. And so I began to, when I was, you know, doing this research, I was faced with this, just this question, you know, why did it seem harder, right, to transform what had been counter memory into the dominant collective memory, right? And this is the process that I'm trying to theorize, at least in one of the chapters. And I began to realize, as you note, that this was not just a difficult past, but a silenced past. And I began to think about the work of one of my colleagues, a fellow sociologist, Tom DeGloma, who writes about different type of mnemonic battles. So mnemonic battles just meaning battles over memory, disputes over memory. And there are different types, right? So there are battles over the nature of the past, right? What actually happened. There's debates over the relevance of the past, right? What does this mean for now? But there's also battles over the existence of the past. Did it happen at all? Is it even worthy of commemoration? And so what I suggest in the book is that the silenced pasts, like we see in Philadelphia, Mississippi, are really fundamentally about even the sort of existence of the past and the commemorability of the past. And those feel like different types of struggles that require different types of demands for the memory activists working in those spaces. And so I do suggest that in addition to commemorability, you know, the sort of general understanding that some instance in the past is worthy of commemoration, and the sort of mnemonic capacity or capacity to commemorate, which is local memory activists actually having the resources they need to be able to commemorate. And by resources, there's a lot of different things, but even just basic sort of funds, right? Basic material resources, that external pressure and what I call interest convergence, drawing on the work of Derek Bell, is also really critical. And we see that in Philadelphia.
So there's these two commemorations that you look at, the first in 1989 and the second in 2004. And you stress that they both have a lot in common, a lot of similarities, but there's an enormous difference in that the 2004 one has transformative repercussions, that it goes beyond the event itself. It has an impact, a wider impact. So in what ways was the 2004 commemoration transformative while the 1989 commemoration wasn't?
Yeah. So I found this really interesting doing the research. Essentially, I'm looking at, 50 years of commemoration and silence. And out of that 50 years, there are 2 years that really stand out as unique, 1989 and 2004. So the 25th anniversary and the 40th anniversary. And as you note, sort of on paper, they look like remarkably similar commemorations. They're organized by interracial groups of sort of local folks who wouldn't call themselves memory activists, but I would call them that. given the context of my field, they invite the families of Cheney Schwerner and Goodman to attend. And in fact, in 89, it was the first time that Carolyn Goodman, Andrew Goodman's mother, had returned to Mississippi since the death of her son. In both cases, the governor of the state, came to lend support and authority and legitimacy to the event. Just comparing them sort of side by side, they look very similar. But what I noticed is that what happened after these commemorative events looked very different. Right? So after 89, things locally in terms of the memory landscape largely returned to their pre-1989 status. Now, I don't want to diminish what was the sort of first and very significant silence-breaking moment that was 1989, but largely it didn't change much on the ground, right? It sort of cracked open possibilities, I think, for what happened in 2004. So in the 40th anniversary, again, very same structure and largely same intention and even conditions around sort of the emergence of this commemoration, but the outcomes were remarkably different. One is that the group who organized it continued to meet, right? So in some ways, the commemoration, the 40th anniversary commemoration, wasn't the ultimate sort of outcome or endpoint of their work together. It actually became the beginning. And in this research, when I was in Mississippi in 2009, again, I said earlier, not planning to write this story or this book, everyone kept talking about Philadelphia, Mississippi, and attributing various things across the state sort of back to this moment in 2004. And so as a social scientist, I had to ask myself, okay, well, this is really interesting. I think these local folks that I'm talking to are really theorizing a causal connection, right? They themselves are positing that remarkable things, and I'll explain it in just a second, could be tied back to the 2004 commemoration. And so I wanted to set out to see if I could actually verify these, emergent theories. One of the things that I do in the book is look at three institutional outcomes that are really statewide and make the case that these can all be traced back to the 2004 commemoration. So the first is the 2005 prosecution of Edgar Ray Killen, who we spoke about before. So the mastermind of the murder was finally held accountable, was charged for murder, ultimately convicted of manslaughter in 2005. So a significant legal outcome that we can trace back to the 40th anniversary in 2004 in Philadelphia. The second is the 2006 passage of Senate Bill 2718. This is a really interesting case. So the This Senate bill is an education bill that mandates civil and human rights education at every grade level across Mississippi. To this day, many years on, I still have not really seen legislation passed at any other state that is sort of broad and far sweeping as this legislation that was passed in 2006. And then finally, the development of the Mississippi Truth Commission that eventually evolved into a sort of decentralized Mississippi Truth Project also can be traced back to the 2004 commemoration.
So you roll up your sleeves as a social scientist and you have to try to make a case. And this is three chapters in your book when you're looking at these outcomes, the trial, the bill, the commission, and you're trying to connect it. So, how difficult was that to make the case that these things maybe weren't solely due to this commemoration, but without it, maybe they might not have happened?
Yeah. It took a lot of work, a lot of historical work, a lot of investigative work. And one of the things that is challenging about studying recent history is that the answers don't live in the archives, right? And so in many cases, I often did feel like an investigative journalist trying to sort of track down leads, hearing from one person who would point me to another and sort of really reconstructing the story. I don't want to bore listeners with the sort of minutiae of my methodology, but I'll just quickly note that I use a method called event structure analysis that is can be a really helpful sort of structured way of doing sort of process tracing, which is to say, you know, connecting the dots, right? And what I do in this is actually start at the end, which in this case would have been the trial, the legislation, the education legislation, and the Truth Commission, and I worked my way backwards. And sure enough, in these three cases, I felt like I could make strong enough connections to show that, yes, while not solely the reason that these three things emerge, I mean, these are very complex social phenomena, right, and institutional changes. Without the 2004 commemoration, I'm really not sure that they would have happened.
Okay, so I think the crux of the book, the heart of the book, is understanding, well, you know, why didn't the organizers just disband at the end of the commemoration? Why didn't it go the way of 1989? And you spent a lot of time looking at the group dynamics. And other resources that came into existence, the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation. And you stressed that there were a lot of new elements. There was a very different way in which this was organized that allowed for this to take on a very different dimension than the 1989 commemoration. So, what was it about how 2004 was organized, the resources that they had in 2004 that maybe didn't exist in 1989, how the group came together in a very different way, how it was able to articulate goals that weren't really there in 1989?
Yeah, let me first answer that with some of the, I guess, macro transformations, right? So when we're comparing two really different cases in two different time periods, it's important to note that, yes, things had changed, right? So in 2004, more so than in 1989, I think there was the sort of a global cultural shift in how, in sort of orientations towards difficult pasts. And I actually do think South Africa's Truth Commission played a large role in sort of transforming how many democratic contexts sort of thought about the role of sort of the past and responsibilities therein. So sort of that, you know, that was in the air, most definitely. Although on the ground, local folks, at least in 2003, 2004, weren't really talking about truth commissions or, you know, global transformations, right? So even though it was, I think, sort of, you know, loosely in the air, I don't think it was deeply consequential in this very local space. Another thing that was really significant is that the state of Mississippi had begun to develop an infrastructure to support heritage tourism around civil rights and the civil rights movement. And that's actually where a lot of the sort of what happened in 2004 began. And the reason that Susan Glisson, who was the director of the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation, what brought her to Philadelphia, Mississippi in the first place was that she was brought in as a consultant to develop some type of a heritage tour locally, highlighting these, you know, civil rights related sites. So sort of that was happening in the state level. And then, as I just mentioned, the existence of the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation, right? So there was an organization that at the time was connected with the University of Mississippi. And the sole purpose of the organization and those working in it was to support local efforts to reckon with histories of racial violence, right? And so we had this institutional infrastructure that was just starting to take place, right? Just starting to take place. So that was happening, all right? And as I was doing this research and writing the book, I felt that even those things, while consequential, still weren't really explaining the fundamental differences between 1989 and 2004. And as you mentioned in your question, one of the major differences was how the groups gathered, was the group dynamics itself. And what I began to realize is, to put it in general terms, the process of commemorating matters for its outcome, right? So I kept noticing that sort of how in 2004 folks were coming together and talking was fundamentally different than in 1989. In 1989, they were doing really important and significant work, but it felt more like event planning, right? They knew folks were coming from across the country. They were going to put on this commemoration. They cared deeply about it. They wanted to rewrite the story of their town, demonstrate to the world that they had, you know, turned a corner, and to reckon with this very difficult past. And in 1989, there's a very moving public apology by Dick Maupas, who was then the Secretary of State and from grew up in Philadelphia, Mississippi. This was the first time a state official had acknowledged the murders and openly apologized to the family members of the victims. So a lot of really important things happened there. I don't want to portray it as just a mere event, right? But the spirit of the organizing was very focused on logistics, right? As most commemorative efforts are. Right? How many chairs? How are we going to feed them? Right? What are we going to say? Who's going to say it? Who's putting up the speakers? Right? Very, very logistically heavy. In 2004, they also had to deal with logistics, but they did something really different. When they began to meet, rather than beginning with logistics, they began with stories. And for most people in the room, it was the first time that they had discussed this past in really interracial company. And this is where my sociologist brain begins to kick in. And I began to sort of think about this moment as an instance of intergroup contact, right? So in what had been a highly segregated community that was not only segregated spatially, but segregated in terms of the stories, the experiences they had of the past, the stories they told about the past, how commemoration was happening in those communities. For folks in what would later be called the Philadelphia Coalition, right, to come together to commemorate this past, to begin with stories, ended up being really consequential. This concept of intergroup contact comes from the work of Gordon Allport and his seminal work, The Nature of Prejudice, which he published in 1954. And in it, he's trying to understand what are the conditions of sort of bringing two groups of people who have historically been in conflict, in this case, you know, like Black Americans and white Americans, right? Bringing them together in ways that actually are productive, reduce stereotypes, and transform people and institutions. And what I discovered is that in 2004, without really meaning to, this group of local memory activists fulfilled the four fundamental conditions for positive intergroup contact. And I could explain more about that, but I'm going to take a breath here for a second. Should I go into sort of what are these conditions?
Sure. That's helpful.
So one of the things is equal status within the context situation. So what was really consequential with the Philadelphia Coalition is that they had two co-chairs, one Black, one white, both deeply respected in the community and in their communities. And they worked collaboratively to develop a plan. So that was really critical. It was a cooperative setting, right? So not set up as competition, right? But really as collaboration. The group developed common goals. This is another condition. So while many of the people coming to the room were coming for different reasons, some of them were more reputationally or economically oriented. Others were there because of their religious convictions. Others were there because their families had been involved and they felt a deep sense of guilt. Others were there because their families had been beaten at Mount Zion on, you know, June 16th prior to the actual 1964 killings, right? So people were coming with really different experiences, really different motivations. But they all ultimately sort of came to an understanding of a shared common goal. They wanted to host this commemoration and they also wanted to seek justice in the case. And then finally, the fourth condition is support by relevant authorities. So the fact that the local mayor was involved was also hugely consequential.
Okay. So it wasn't like they intended to go beyond the commemoration, that this just happened, that the group met, they shared stories they hadn't told before. They also had this unique resource of the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation, maybe an especially talented person with Susan Glisson, who was able to be the moderator of those debates. Maybe they wouldn't have gone in the direction that they went in. So she was able to mediate those intergroup dialogues and to make them something constructive, right? And eventually they come up with this larger goal of justice.
Yes, a larger goal, and also I should add a shared identity, right? So over and over again, when I talked with folks who had been involved in this group, they begin to see themselves as members of the Philadelphia Coalition. Right. Not as members of sort of separate experiences or separate groups, but they developed a really shared identity and a shared commitment. And it was through this intense storytelling, and you're absolutely right, facilitated storytelling. And Susan Glisson really did serve as an important moderator when things got challenging, and they did. And yeah, it was through the storytelling and through, I should mention one more condition actually. So, you know, Gordon Allport's work has these, you know, four conditions. But in 1998, a social psychologist by the name of Thomas Pettigrew theorized a fifth condition. And I think this fifth condition is actually especially consequential in this case. And it's what he calls friendship potential. Right. So, and friendship potential is this notion that there should be informal personal interactions between out-group members. Right. And I think this is really interesting to think about in the context of many of the commemorative efforts I've even been involved in, because most of them, you know, folks come into the room and they sort of begin with the business of organizing. That's not what this group did. The Philadelphia Coalition began by getting to know each other. And this seems really insignificant. But in the context of commemorating histories of racial violence in spaces where this history has not been discussed and where people coming from different backgrounds, experiences, and just racial identities are coming together to have that conversation, in order to set the stage for what could possibly be a transformative commemoration, really does require the sort of the stuff of intergroup dialogue, right? It is an instance of intergroup contact. And I think the lessons from social psychology are really critical here.
Okay. So they articulate this goal of justice. So if you're going to try to make a claim, well, you know, how are these larger outcomes connected to this? Well, they reopening that trial was at the top of their list, right? And they get the help of the Winter William Institute in making this case and trying to build support for it, holding a, I think it was, you mentioned, it was a big press conference that started to build momentum for this. So they had these resources, but they had this common goal that they didn't necessarily start off with.
Correct.
And that led to the reopening of the trial. And you mentioned later on, well, that Truth Commission is meeting right about the time that trial and the outcome of the trial is being made public. So it just, you have these events that feed into each other.
Yeah. And I think the sort of temporal order of those events matters a lot, right? So we have, you know, this interracial group of local Neshoba Countyans who are coming together and initially to host this 40th anniversary commemoration through the process of getting to know each other, a really deeply emotional process of connection. They develop this common goal, which is justice in this case. Then there's still a big question about, well, what does that mean? Right. What would justice look like, and what is even possible? But ultimately, what emerges is a call through a very public press conference by the group, with the assistance of Susan Glisson, for the state to reopen the case. Ultimately, that call is answered, and the case moves forward. It really wasn't until, well, let me back up for a second. So, once the trial concluded, there was a sense that there was still more to be done, right? That this was, that any legal case has limitations because it's really adjudicating sort of what, you know, the case of one person and what they did. When the Philadelphia Coalition, and again, the William Winter Institute and many others felt that there needed to be a broader understanding of state complicity, and the sort of structural conditions that had facilitated or allowed for this killing to happen. I think there's a really significant quote that comes out of that press conference. Let me see if I can remember it right. It was something about how, you know, the Klan, you know, Klansmen may have pulled the trigger, but the state of Mississippi like aimed the weapon. Right, something along those lines. So there was really a desire to try to broaden out the sense of what justice might look like. And that's where this idea of a statewide education bill begins to circulate, right? So that way it's not just one case, right? One legal case, but actually sort of transforming the way that this education gets taught, and then ultimately the Truth Commission as well.
And people are sharing these very personal, very emotional stories. And there's an awareness, especially members of the white community, that they haven't gotten any of this in school. That this is, a lot of this is new to them. So that creates the drive for work on education. You mentioned they bring in somebody from the outside who's got an educational background. It's the William Winter Institute again. They have a student, a graduate student who drafts this bill that gets broadened, becomes law.
Yeah. I want to jump into here real fast because I think, you know, we've mentioned the William Winter Institute several times, and it is really significant. And I've definitely had people respond to my work by saying, well, wasn't it the Winter Institute and not the commemoration itself? Wasn't it Susan Glisson and, you know, not the Philadelphia Coalition? And I understand where that's coming, and I certainly do not want to diminish the work of that organization and Susan in particular. It is remarkable, but I think it's really important to remember that at the time the William Winter Institute was just beginning, right? So it didn't yet have legitimacy in the state, and not only that, being associated with the University of Mississippi, which has a dubious racial history of its own, also complicated things for the William Winter Institute and for Susan, right? And so my, I guess, understanding of this period in time is that it was this really sort of symbiotic relationship between the Winter Institute and the Philadelphia Coalition, meaning that the Winter Institute and Susan Glisson in particular, provided necessary institutional supports for what this local grassroots memory organization was trying to do. But then this group and what they were able to accomplish in turn then created the legitimacy for the William Winter Institute that allowed them in the subsequent years to be able to do what they ended up going on to do. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. So are you optimistic that this is a model of what happens in Philadelphia? Could be something that happens a lot of different places.
Yeah.
I mean, can you make the case that if you can take a history as silenced and as difficult as what happened in Neshoba County, and people come together, and they don't just come together to acknowledge it, but they have these big outcomes, a change in education, trials of people who hadn't been tried. You have truth commissions that become like oral history projects, I guess, later on.
Absolutely.
Could this happen elsewhere, or do you feel like this was just a unique set of circumstances, a unique set of resources and people in that particular place?
Yeah, I'm hesitant to suggest that there's a formula here that can be distilled, and yet I do think that there are very clear insights that can be adopted and adapted in different settings. So I mean, one thing that's really critical is a statewide infrastructure to support this work. So very few states have the type of significant organizations that the William Winter Institute was at that time. And I think that played a really critical role in supporting this work. But I think one of my really big takeaways, just my personal learnings in this and what I try to articulate in the book, is that how a group goes about doing the commemoration, right? Planning the commemoration, the sort of process of commemorating really matters for and really shapes possibilities for the future. I've referenced before, I'm involved in a lot of these projects at my university, in my community. And despite having written a book about this, it is still really hard to make space in busy lives to do the tough work of building friendship potential within these groups, right? But I really think it's necessary because, you know, if the goal is for these commemorative efforts to be a beginning as opposed to being the end point, right? So I think there's definitely lessons to be learned. I also do think, of course, that this was a very unique moment in the history of Mississippi.
Clara, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Clara Whitlinger is an associate professor of sociology and the founder and co-director of the Intergroup Dialogue Program at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. I've been talking with her about her book, Between Remembrance and Repair, Commemorating Racial Violence in Philadelphia, Mississippi. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.